I'm very pleased to announce the next session, an in-conversation session with Brad Jones, who's the Assistant Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia. Brad is responsible for the bank's work on financial stability, including, among many responsibilities, producing the Financial Stability Review, which is a must-read for anybody in our industry, as well as the bank's oversight of the payment system. And it's in relation to the latter that the topic will be the central topic of the discussion today, and in particular, the groundbreaking work that's taking place in the area of central bank digital currency, something we've been asked about a lot as we go around and talk to members and other regulators. Tim Adams will moderate the conversation. Please welcome Brad and Tim to the stage.
Thank you for joining us here today. It was very important that we had someone from RBA here today. You guys are world leaders in so many different parts of central banking, and especially on the piece on CBDC. So as I said earlier, and maybe you were in here or not, the last 5 years, I traveled around the world. I went to a lot of conferences, took lots of notes, read lots of papers from the BIS and others on central bank digital currencies. And I must say, I probably underestimated how fast this process was moving. I thought it more in a theoretical rather than a practical application basis. And then it just seems in the last 6 months, there's been a real acceleration. Every central banker I've talked to, from South Africa to Japan, to the Fed, to the ECB, are all now talking about their pilots, short time frames. We're at design parameters. The BIS has invited us to spend several days with them over the course of the next few months as they think about where we are in the decision tree in terms of design. So tell us a little bit about how you see central bank digital currencies generally. Am I on the right track? And are we seeing acceleration? And is this simply preparing to implement, or is this real implementation? So maybe just the general arc, and then we'll get to what's going on here.
Sure. Well, thanks. Thanks, Tim. My sense is there's both a common element to what's generating this momentum that you're speaking to. And then there's a whole host of country-specific factors. So the common element is that there is clearly profound structural change in the way that commercial activity is conducted, the digitization of the economy. And that is raising really profound questions about the role of money in the digital era. We obviously are all observing a structural decline in transaction-related demand for cash. And so there are big questions, almost philosophical questions, being raised about the role of money, public and private money, and their interaction in that sort of a context. And then there's a host of, as I say, country-specific factors. So for instance, in China, the principal driver of their interest in a CBDC has been financial stability issues. Policymakers there are very concerned that you had vast amounts of stored value being held by these payment companies that were sitting outside the traditional regulatory umbrella. In Sweden, the issue's been very different. The decline of cash, I think, is well recognized there. In the euro area, their principal concern has been a concern that foreign tech companies would effectively displace bank intermediation, and those foreign tech companies, for instance, some large US tech companies, would be operating outside of the euro area financial regulatory umbrella, and that would disrupt, you know, potentially monetary policy transmission there. The US is really interesting, and I probably don't need to tell you this, but I have absolutely detected a shift in the last 18 months or so, growing support, particularly in Congress, behind the idea that the primacy of the US dollar, its role in the international financial system, could be at risk if all the others race ahead and the US sits behind. Now, there's some big hurdles to cover there. The enabling legislation piece you mentioned is just one of them. And then in low-income countries, they've got a whole different range of motivation, mainly related to looking to a CBDC to increase financial inclusion. So, as I said, there's one common element, and then there's a whole bunch of country-specific factors that I think dictating the speed with which different countries are moving.
And is there a concern, given that different countries are moving at different speeds, maybe different design parameters, that we constrain interoperability in the way in which these different currencies will work?
I mean, that's one consideration, but ultimately these are going to be decisions made by policymakers, in individual countries. So, and each country's, as I mentioned, driven by different motivations and has different constraints. And so the interoperability piece is a very technical way to look at it. I think this actually connects to far larger issues, and in almost all countries will require changes in legislation. So it will be inevitably and inherently a political a task that is before us. It's not going to turn purely on technological arguments.
Indeed, and it feels like the Europeans are advancing pretty quickly. And I agree with you. If MasterCard and Visa were European, we probably have a different outcome, but it is what it is. So I'm not, I'm not going to get involved in their decision-making process. But because Europe seems to be moving so fast now, the Brits seem to have caught on to that. And to your point about the dollar, there is discussions that the U.S. doesn't want to be left behind if the rest of the world moves along. But the interoperability is key, given that I saw Augustin Carstens, the head of the BIS, and I said to him, "What is it? What's the problem you're trying to solve, Augustin?" And he said, "My wife wants to send money from Basel to Mexico, and it's hard to do, and it's expensive. So is the cross-border component of this also important, as well as intra-country operations?"
Yeah, it is. The cross-border piece is probably one of the arguments in favor of a CBDC that has near universal support across both emerging market and advanced economies. I'm happy to speak to this a bit later if you like, but advanced economies tend to focus on a subset of issues. For emerging market or lower income countries, they tend to be animated more by a different set of issues, but the cross-border piece cuts it right across. In Australia, for instance, and we're not unique at all, it still costs on average around 5% to send your money abroad, and those transactions can take up to a couple of days to settle, which is clearly unsatisfactory. In other advanced economies, those metrics are very similar, and that's why cross-border payments getting costs down and the settlement times up is a key priority for the FSB, among others.
One last question, and we'll come to the specifics here. There is concern among our membership, obviously, that retail versus wholesale, and retail being a process in which we're disintermediated. Is that fear overblown, or is it something you're concerned about as well?
So on the retail piece, yeah, there are basically two concerns that central banks have raised with respect to the introduction of a retail CBDC, and it is a quite important distinction, the wholesale retail divide. The first concern is that if in normal times households and businesses decide that they want to park their liquidity in CBDC, in central bank deposits effectively, rather than commercial bank deposits, the result of that would potentially be central banks would find themselves inundated with deposits they don't need and can't productively invest. On the other hand, commercial banks who do need deposits as a source of funding in this country, 60% of bank funding comes from deposits, which is a 20 percentage point increase since prior to the GFC. So we've become more dependent in this country on deposit funding. That if that funding was no longer available to commercial banks, they would either have to source that funding from more expensive or more volatile sources, or quite radically change how they distribute credit. The funding and lending models would potentially be severely impacted, and that would have implications for monetary policy transmission, because in countries like Australia's, monetary policy transmits through the banking system. So that's one set of issues. The other set, that's in normal times.
Right, right.
Then you've got the stress periods.
Stress, right.
And the risk here is that if households had the ability to run into a CBDC at a time where they were very concerned about an individual bank or the banking system en masse, that by having a CBDC there without limit, if it could be held without limit, then you're making it easier to facilitate bank runs, because rather than having to queue outside a commercial bank branch and go and bury that cash in your backyard or under the mattress, the stroke of a keyboard, you've run out of a commercial bank into the CBDC. So they're the two concerns that have been raised by, you know, our colleagues internationally. And we're, as you can imagine, we're having very frequent conversations about the sorts of remedial measures or the measures that you could consider to try and dampen those risks. Most of those measures, one way or another, boil down to restricting the use or limiting the use of a CBDC, for instance, by imposing caps or limits on how much any individual could hold. So Bank of England,
right,
a couple of weeks ago, have indicated a £10,000 cap, for instance. Or you could have caps on transaction sizes. Some have suggested you could impose negative interest rates to disincentivize the holding of a CBDC, or you could impose penalties on withdrawals from bank deposits into CBDC in periods of stress, in the same way that you get hit with early redemption fees from money market funds now.
Right.
So there's a whole host of sort of remedial measures that the researchers have proposed, but what they all have in common is that they're all designed to limit or restrict the use of a CBDC, which in turn, in my mind, raises an interesting question about, well, if the solution of the problem is actually to restrict the use of the thing in the first place,
why do you need it?
Where's all this going? So anyway, so these are all the questions that we're wrestling with internally and obviously engaging internationally.
So why don't we change the aperture of our focus and focus now on what you're doing here in Australia. So how do you think about this in terms of retail, wholesale, and the design parameters? Is taking into consideration what you just said, what your other colleagues are doing around the world, how are you thinking about its application here in this country?
Why don't I maybe answer that through the prism of our current research focus right now, which is our pilot, our EAUD pilot program. The bank's been doing research on CBDC for a number of years. We've run a couple of proof of concept exercises with peer central banks and industry. What we're doing now is a bit different. In fact, it's unique in a couple of ways. First of all, to try and better understand what the use case could be for an economy and a financial system like Australia's, rather than prescribing a specific use case for industry to examine, we have provided industry with a blank digital canvas to come up with their own proposals and tell us how a CBDC could be used. We didn't want to be so intellectually, arrogant as to think we have all the answers here. We have a financial system, fintech system here, and I see some people with us from it today who are very talented. We wanted to tap into that talent and see and really put it out to industry to come and tell us, show us, demonstrate to us what the use case could be. The second feature that's unique is this: in the pilot program, this will be a real digital claim on the Reserve Bank. This is not just an exercise being conducted in a sort of abstract sandbox. And the reason that we've gone down that path is because we are learning things from a legal perspective, regulatory perspective, technological perspective, would be hard to do if we were just playing in the sandbox. So that's basically what the pilot is about. We're engaged in this project with our partners, the Digital Finance Cooperative Research Center, we have actively engaged with industry on this. We've been really pleasantly surprised by the level of industry engagement. When we first put out a call for expressions of interest, if you like, we received 140 submissions from more than 80 entities. We've since whittled that list down to a much more manageable number that we'll take into the formal part of the pilot very shortly, and we'll make an announcement quite soon about the next phase of the pilot that will get going in April and May. But what I can say here is that the use case proposals are very diverse, and they have been proposed by a wide range of industries, a wide range of entities, across the financial system, ranging from small fintechs and small digital asset firms, all the way up to some very large, well-established financial institutions. That's been pleasing. So this is really where our focus is right now. This project will culminate in a publicly available report, which we hope to publish around the middle of the year. So that will be a great time for us to sort of take stock of what we've learned. But I would just conclude by saying that as important as this pilot is, and it's certainly taking up a lot of our time and attention right now, it is only going to be one additional input along a journey. And we have a pretty expansive research agenda over the next few years. And so this is one piece of a much larger puzzle. It's not going to provide the final assessment, if you like.
So on the timeline, so mid-year, you'll come back with a point of reflection. Mm-hmm. But does it also require legislation, government support? What does the arc of approval look like? Is that a year or 5-year process? Just give me a sense of timing.
Yeah, I couldn't be quite so specific on timing. What I can say, though, is this is a decision to issue particularly a general purpose or a retail CBDC is a discussion that is going to involve many, many stakeholders, the government being clearly having a central role in this in more ways than one. So it's not a decision that the Reserve Bank would arrive at unilaterally.
And on the use case, the myriad of use case suggestions that came your way, were there any surprises or any of those use cases that you can share that you thought were unusually innovative?
So we're going to have an announcement very shortly about those that have been invited to move out of the sandbox and into the live pilot phase. What I can say is that there were a wide range of use case proposals covering things like areas like offline payments, which I think is really interesting, facilitating atomic settlement in tokenized real and financial assets. They're probably the main ones.
And in terms of the region, are you watching how quickly others in the region are moving, and does that affect the pace with which your timeline might be adjusted one way or the other?
So on the region, well, first of all, we're obviously speaking with our peers all the time on these issues, and a number of proof of concept exercises that central banks have done is with other central banks. And so we are constantly engaged in conversations about what the next project might look like. And those discussions are underway as we speak. In Asia specifically, what I can say is that, as you would imagine, given how diverse the region is, countries are moving at very different speeds. So the Chinese, have had a program, a research program underway for the better part of a decade now, although the take-up in their pilot's been pretty moderate, for want of a better term.
Indeed.
It looks like the Indians and the Thais are probably the next cabs off the rank there. Across the entire region, about one third of countries in Asia have either engaged in a pilot or a proof of concept exercise, and almost all of the rest are at least in a research phase. So we're all moving at different speeds based on different motivations. But just because one country in the region moved, that wouldn't necessarily dictate that we would move. And let me just. This is actually an important point, so if I can just
please
sort of give a concrete example of this. One of the cases that has been made for why countries should move to introduce a general purpose CBDC in particular is that you could cede monetary sovereignty, that if banknotes were no longer freely circulating in your country, and you didn't have a domestic CBDC, and your trading partners did, that CBDC would find its way into your country. Now, what you're basically talking about there is a form of currency substitution.
Exactly.
And as I'm sure you remember, currency substitution, if it were to take effect, would pose very material problems for the transmission of monetary policy and the safeguarding of financial stability. But the history of, there's a deep history of literature on what determines whether a country will face currency substitution. And on my reading, at least, they have very little, if anything, to do with issues of technical form of the currency. What they have to do with is quality of your institutions, your economic, your policy-making institutions, your financial quality of your financial institutions, the rule of law, and whether domestic residents and foreign investors have reason to question the integrity of your currency. Now, those conditions that I just set out that typically have determined whether you are vulnerable to that or not, they're just not apparent in Australia. And so even if, say, the Chinese were to move a fully fledged way toward ECNY, I struggle to conceive of a world where Australians are importing the ECNY and can readily conducting transactions.
Maybe Venezuela, maybe Argentina, right? Given the lack of confidence in the domestic currency and domestic institutions, you could see the importation of other currencies. But outside that, it's hard to make the case here.
Not here.
Yeah. We just have a couple of minutes. I think you're willing to take one or two questions, but it has to be on this topic. If it's not about this topic, we're not going to take it. So I have a sheer discipline about this topic. So it's about this topic. We've got a gentleman right here.
Thank you for your presentation. That was very interesting. Just a quick question on your thoughts on stablecoin. I mean, to your point about currency substitution, cryptocurrency is already engaging in currency substitution now. It's just not doing it in a way that's very stable. Just interested in the Reserve's thoughts on bank-issued and third-party-issued stablecoin and how that's informing your thoughts on a centrally issued currency.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the question. We're very open-minded about about the case for a stablecoin, in fact, about a reserve-backed payment stablecoin. We could see a world where you had, say, tokenized deposits and reserve-backed stablecoins, reserve-backed payment stablecoins, taking effect in the economy and obviating a lot of the need for a CBDC. We can also equally see a world where they all circulate. An example might be, for instance, where you had a reserve-backed payment stablecoin, where the reserve backing the assets backing that stablecoin were a combination of Australian government bills and CBDC. And that stablecoin was held in your digital wallet provided by a non-bank private payment service provider, for instance. So you would have basically a CBDC providing a foundational layer, if you like, and then there would be private innovation on top of that public layer, public money, and that private innovation would take the form of the stable coin and the digital wallet and all the services
that are programmable and other.
That's right. All those features, right, that go around it, because this actually connects to a larger issue, which is that the history of our money over the part of the last couple of centuries is that we have a two-tier system here in Australia, in the US, and elsewhere, where central banks provide core foundational public goods relating to the supply of public money in a prudent way, consistent with the demands for it, that allow it to be a medium of exchange, by providing the infrastructure and the balance sheet to settle transactions irrevocably.
Right.
And thirdly, to underwrite confidence in the monetary system to promote trust and exchange. They are the sort of public goods that central banks provide. We recognize central banks can't and shouldn't do everything. And there is a key role for the private sector then to take those public goods as sort of foundational building blocks and then layer on top private services, because central banks have no comparative advantage in providing the sort of direct customer facing services that you all in this room are well equipped to provide. You're constantly innovating and adapting your business models to provide households and businesses with choice and, you know, the best products at the lowest cost. That's your comparative advantage, and our comparative advantage is providing the sort of the foundational layer, if you like, on which you can all build. And so that's kind of the intellectual framework, if you like, for how we're thinking about the possible interaction of, say, a CBDC and stablecoins in the future.
Right, we're out of time. Thank you for coming here today. I know you're in the blackout period, so just getting
just
you
about,
here.
Not yet,
just
about
this afternoon. So thank you for coming here. We appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity to share your thoughts. It's the most succinct assessment of this really difficult topic I've heard in a long time. So thank you. And thank you for allowing the industry to have input as you think through these design parameters. Ladies and gentlemen, please give them a round of applause.
Thank you.